Hello everyone and welcome to this webinar. I'm Francis Seeley from Enfield Climate Action Forum. And today we're going to look at climate change as an emergency. Now, strange to say that because climate change is an emergency and local authorities and other organisations have made a declaration of emergency around climate change. But we have to ask, are those just words that they use without thinking about it? Or do they look upon it as a real emergency and they plan for it as an emergency? Well, today we're lucky because we have Sarah Eastwood with us, who is the Emergency Planning Manager in the North Mid Hospital Trust. And we're going to talk to her about that today and go through some of the issues that are involved. So Sarah, thank you for joining us today and for taking part, and we really appreciate it. But it will be nice to begin with if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Thank you. Thank you, Francis. And thank you for inviting me. I'm Yorkshire born and bred originally. So I came down to London 30 years ago. I've been here 30 years. I live in Waltham Forest. I have a child who goes to school in Hackney. I have a stepchild who was born and brought up in Wood Green. Obviously, I work in North Mid now, and I've worked in health service in North London in various health organisations for the last 20 years, North Mid for over 20 years, North Mid for the last 10 years. So I've got a big, I suppose, vested interest in North London and all things North London. I also have, just a very brief background, I've got degrees in an interest, I suppose, in economics and in photography. I'm currently doing an MSc in climate change. I've travelled extensively and have the guilt associated with that from all the air flights. I've got an allotment where I escape. I think that's broadly me.
Well, that's really interesting because it shows you her real commitment to sustainable living and climate change. But you're also the Emergency Planning Manager at the North Mid. What does that mean?
It's a role that is in all hospitals. Under the Civil Contingencies Act 2004, a large number of organisations have a legal duty to be prepared to deal with any types of incidents or emergencies that impact on their communities. And that means that we need to be prepared for any kinds of shocks, any kinds of accidents or incidents that might affect our staff, our organisation, and bring casualties into the organisation.
So in that case, if there's a major incident like a train crash, that's something you deal with. And presumably you don't deal with it yourself. You work with the police, you work with local authorities, and it's got to be cross-boundary in a sense.
Yes, it's absolutely fundamental to emergency planning that it's a community. It's a resilience community, as we call it. And we are a player with our colleagues across fire, ambulance, police, counter-terrorism, local authority, and then other sectors, so the rest of health in this patch and London, but also things like utility companies, local businesses, etc. So there's close relationships. The closer parts for us are with our other health associated responders and the local authority, but and the police, but they're all extremely close relationships. And what we are tasked with doing is both communicating and collaborating effectively, but also having plans that we share with each other and that make sense to each other.
So there has to be a continual planning dialogue with all of you. I mean, something I read about emergency planning said that there are four phases of emergency planning: mitigation, preparedness, response, and recovery. Does that sort of sum up the context in which you work?
It does. It does. I would add, although it is sort of folded into those words, as you sort of said in your introduction, words can mean or phrases can mean all sorts of things. But I think it's good to pull out a couple of other things. One of them is risk assessment. So the sort of beginning part in a way of all this process is assessment of the risks. And we locally assess obviously, but we also assess in the context of the National Risk Register, the London Risk Register, and the two boroughs, Haringey and Enfield Risk Register. So risk assessment's fundamental to know what we think we're going to be dealing with, we need to be able to deal with. Also, I'd still pull out the communication and collaboration, which is sort of folded into all those parts. And then the other key element is learning and evaluation, which we also do with our partners. But whenever we do respond to something, we need to stop afterwards when the dust has settled, think about how it went, what we can learn from it, and how we can respond better next time, because there's always something you can improve.
Okay, so that's quite extensive. Well, let's talk about climate change, because in a way, that's slightly different. I mean, when you deal with an incident like a train crash, that's an incident. But climate change is a public health emergency as well. And when you respond to that, you're not always responding to an incident. You're responding to an emergency that is ongoing. Now, does that require you to have a different way of thinking about it than when you just deal with an individual incident?
It's a really good question. And it kind of plays to something that I'm particularly interested in, because I think it fundamentally is about emergency planning and resilience. Because awareness of what that bigger picture are is what feeds your understanding of what you need to be resilient to. But I suppose one way for me of thinking about it in terms of the local health system or our hospital is the sort of three aspects to it. There's the aspect where you're responding to an incident that may be related to the climate, an ecological crisis. So it may be heat, it may be infrastructure supply failures, it may be any of those sorts of things. But also you need to think about the fact that as an organisation, we are critically dependent on a whole lot of systems and infrastructures, and we need to be not only able to respond to the casualties coming in from an incident, but we need day to day to be able to keep functioning and keep people safe. So we have to think about how we are resilient in that way. But the other thing we need to be very mindful of is that we're a big, huge contributor to this whole crisis, you know, and as the wider society and industry is. But, you know, we are reliant on massive supply chains. We are a huge energy and resource user. We are a huge waste emitter and waste and CO2 emitter. And that's not to pull North Mid out and say we're the bad guys. That's what we're all like. And we all need to face that and think what our role in creating the problem, as well as trying to help pick up some of the results of the problem.
That's something we've dealt with in other webinars, and it's really important. How do you make the workplace that you're in greener and more sustainable? And that's something you've raised, and quite rightly so. But in terms of the public health impact of climate change, have you really identified any particular dangers there that you think that we should begin to plan long term and concentrate on?
It depends how big you want to go. Because obviously, when you think about it, you need to be thinking about whether we're talking short term or long term, and also whether we're talking with a global north developed country, or what's already hitting global south and small island states and etc. But what's hitting others will hit us, you know, so this is just a matter of time, and it may hit us in different ways. I guess what we're faced with more immediately are clearly the impacts of heat waves and heat island effect in a large city, and other extremes of weather. So flooding and cold weather is less of a risk at the moment, but you know, with the fluctuations, we have to be ready for that. I think water stress, infrastructure failures is going to be increasingly and very quickly a larger issue. There are then concerns, obviously there's huge risk around ongoing pandemics, so not just our current pandemic, but that will become increasingly, subsequent pandemics will be part of our daily life, unfortunately. And one of the other things that we need to be very mindful of is the mental health impact. I feel it's that the mental health impact from all aspects of, so from particular incidents, but also from the increasing awareness of the challenges, I think, that people are facing, and that is going to be a significant challenge for communities.
So, I mean, you know, take that example, because that's a good one. Where mental health is a real issue in terms of climate change. And you talked about heat stress. We know in Paris in 2019, many, many, many people died. And they were people who were living alone and elderly, and in many cases, women. And also, you know, it caused anxiety and mental health problems. So when you've got something like heat stress, you've got lots of people who are socially isolated. How can you plan long-term for that? What do you do around that?
I think this is where it becomes very clear that you cannot operate as individual organisations. Obviously, you have to operate as communities and cross sectors. We have well-developed heat response plan, and that follows a lot of very, very well-developed evidence about the impacts of heat on health, and the particular complicating factors around vulnerable communities and vulnerable individuals. And so, you know, our plans, the same as other organisations' plans, are very much focused on that. But I suppose we assume our partners are doing similar, and our close partners, obviously, we speak to regularly, and we know they're doing similar. What we don't really have that we're not tasked to do, because it's a wider public health challenge, I guess, wider than health challenge, is look at how we recognise as a community that not only do we need to think about where we're transgressing, the boundaries of the climate in terms of pushing the limits, but also where we are allowing parts of our communities to fall below a foundation level where they're actually properly protected. And I think that's where I'm not talking from Northbid, I'm talking from all of us. We aren't working sufficiently on that one yet.
No, I think probably most people aren't, and it's a real problem. But I mean, with heat stress, for example, I mean, do you see your role and the role of your partners is merely responding to an incident? So you, for example, have refuges where people could go to cool down. Or do you also see a part of your role is working with communities to build community resilience as well?
It is. But it's, I suppose, if you were looking strictly speaking at how the role is defined, it's a smaller part of the role. It's more around communication and engagement. I believe that we actually need to be working further in that way. But we, you know, in all honesty, that's not one of the clear framings of it for a hospital trust. And I think that needs to change.
Yeah, I mean, that's difficult when you have a sort of business model and you have to, and the whole climate change situation really challenges that business model. The same is true with air pollution, isn't it? I mean, clearly you deal with respiratory conditions that come from air pollution. And if there is a real big pollution attack, you would deal with that as an incident. But do you also, and it's a bit like the other question, I mean, do you also concern yourself with, you know, the need to measure pollution correctly and to address its causes?
Well, I mean, air pollution wouldn't fall under an incident. So we currently don't have a way that we would, in terms of an EP framework. So this is, I'm just thinking in terms of the sort of formal role, that we would define an event as an air pollution incident. What it is, I think for me particularly, because it's incredibly important, is that it's a complicating factor on a number of existing incidents. And one of the challenges that generally we are going to increasingly find with the climate and ecological crisis is not only the frequency of incidents occurring will be higher, but also the frequency of multiple incidents at the same time. And so, you know, the classic recent one is you have COVID-19, and you have a heat wave and you have air pollution. And those are that you've got a double incident plus a complicating factor. And if you add that into an already vulnerable community, then you're talking about layers of complication that you need, you know, you need to factor that in when you're looking at your response plan. But we don't have a role in monitoring air pollution. We need to be better at managing our own pollution that we emit. But I think from my point of view, the NHS net zero plan is still focused a little bit too much on carbon emissions and not on wider challenges. And I think, you know, as a community, let's be honest, we know we sit here on the edge of the North Circular, which is horrendous pollutant. You know, I can see from my office window the chimney of the incinerator, the Edmonton incinerator, and there's no place for, you know, currently in a climate and ecological crisis for burning of waste. So the pollution and the toxins that come out of that are a complication factor for us. But as a hospital, we don't have a sort of specific role in that, in how we sort of challenge those wider community choices.
Isn't it important for you and health authorities generally to have as valid and reliable information on something like air pollution as you can? Because there is some doubt that both nationally and locally, we don't get the most reliable and valid information.
Yeah, you mean on risk, so when there are high pollution days, etc.
Well, that plus the level of pollution and the measurements of particulates, which I think you were mentioning, that aren't necessarily just carbon dioxide.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, I agree with you. But I think also what we need to be very clear about is that measuring it's not going to be the solution to it. It's actually stopping it. And, you know, the same, I think, you know, with the sort of big picture, even globally, is that the focus is on targets and setting in agreeing targets. And in actual fact, we need to be on the very much on the next page there with reducing. So we know without measuring, we know what we need to be reducing. We need to be reducing it and measuring how, you know, how the levels are coming down. But we need to be definitely firmly on that next page of getting of bringing down any of the extreme pollution creators that we already know are there. And we're currently, if anything, investing in them rather than disinvesting.
That's quite interesting because, I mean, clearly the health authority can't be a political organisation. But what sort of interests me is lots of people in the health authorities are also climate change activists. Is that because, you know, there's a realisation in the health authority now that climate change is really a big issue?
I that's a good question. I'm not sure whether there's, and it comes down to your question about monitoring and measuring, I suppose. I'm not sure whether there are more people in the health sector than in other sectors that are climate activists. I think there's a certain power in the message, which is positive and important, when a message about a climate emergency being a public emergency is delivered by people who you know and trust as your clinical, local clinical professionals or national clinical professionals. And I think, you know, I think fair play and great action for people to promote in that message. I think that the science, for anyone who's sort of actually, you know, has the opportunity to really look into any of the science and facts is so clear and has been so clear for so long. If you're talking about any profession where people are interested in sort of evidence base or research or science, then I would expect them to be fairly clear about what the impact of the climate and ecological crisis is actually going to be, because it's been there in black and white for decades.
But where the health authority can be heavily involved in is changes in lifestyle, isn't it, that make people healthier, dealing with active travel, looking at diets and so on. And that's a part of developing individual resilience, isn't it?
Yes. And individual resilience needs to be enabled by organisation action. So, I think I worry when too much of this is pushed down just to individuals. But I think that we certainly need to be very clear about, I'll say concrete plans, but concrete's obviously in this context a bad word to use, but concrete plans for how we are enabling our staff and our patients, for example, to travel to an organisation like this and to have healthcare provided by an organisation like this without getting in cars and getting here. And there's a long way to go on that one yet. And I do worry that the health system is more fragmented now than is ideal for pulling that collaboration together. And that the public health function, I think, is in my view, has been not invested in enough for a nationally, that is not a local decision, for a significant amount of time. And that's where you would get this drive pulled together also to sort of share that evidence and bring forward some cross-community enabling work that would allow people to live healthier lives.
So if you had your way, what sort of collaborative networks would you want to see in place to make what you want more effective?
I would be very excited about working in a way that is more transformative and less and not trying to take it forward in a top-down way. I think that there is a space for having discussion with communities at a very grassroots level about what will make their lives feel richer and healthier and richer in the enrichment way, well-being way, on a day-to-day basis. And that would then encompass things such as how they get about, how they network with their communities, how they engage with nature and green space, how they keep their housing and their home and their livelihoods and their children healthy. And I think that for me to sort of have that kind of work and for us to be part of understanding what people need and what we can contribute as equal partners with each, you know, with individuals, would be an exciting way forward.
So that's a bottom-up approach, isn't it? Where the community becomes an equal partner to the statutory authorities, where you learn from them as well as they learn from you. And we are moving in that direction, but we haven't quite got it yet, have we?
And I think the thing that that needs to be very much embedded in that is the recognition about where inequality and justice sits in all aspects of climate and ecological pressure and incidents and, you know, et cetera, but the sort of wider climate and ecological crisis is fundamentally a justice one. And if we don't address that, we are never going to be make enough transition to actually to have a sort of possibility of managing what's coming down the line.
And you say that because vulnerable communities are the ones most adversely affected by climate change.
Yes, they're most adversely affected, and they're also least in a position to sort of have alternatives and to survive shocks, as it were. You know, they won't have savings, they won't have alternative strategies, they won't have etc. And they have traditionally less power in the decision making about where resources are committed.
So a lot of what you've just been saying is about prevention, preventative measures, and the development of resilience. So do you see those two things as being a part of the emergency planning portfolio? Would you like to embrace that, or is that something that gets embraced in a collaborative network?
I personally feel that it should be embraced within an emergency planning network. That does mean that needs to be you know, it's a very big challenge then. But I certainly, I think it's they're so closely interlinked. Plus, the scale of the challenges that we're facing are too big for us to be able to adapt our way out of it. We actually need to very, very fast and very actively reduce the scale of the challenge, as well as adapt to what's left of the challenge, because it will still be a huge, huge amount of adaptation that we will need.
So you talk about it as being a challenge, which it is. Do you think people are sort of now really beginning to wake up to that challenge? Has COVID, for example, helped people to wake up to that challenge? Are you hopeful about the future on this?
It depends. Sometimes I'm hopeful, sometimes I'm not. I think, you know, I'm a parent, so you have to be hopeful, and you have to. I think what's important is that we're clear how serious the situation is, really clear how serious it is, but then we don't use that to give up hope, because the point is then we have, you know, the 1.5 degree of warming is gone. We can't stay within that. And above that is going to be, you know, is already baked in significant change. But it's, you know, there are scales of how bad it can be, and we need to make sure it's not, you know, it's less bad than it could be. I think that I always try and be hopeful. I think the hope will be there in wider awareness and in enabling people to actually be part of challenging current structures and influencing decisions that are taken going forward. But it's got to be a different way of working to the way that we currently run ourselves, all of us.
I think the challenge is for all of us that it has to be a different way of working. I think that's something we're all struggling through, and I think some organisations find it more difficult than others. We've sort of come to the end of the 30 minutes now, so let me ask you, I mean, if anybody wants to know more about what you do and find out more, then where would they go?
So if you come to North Mid, you can either go in through Switchboard or go in through the comms team. And you've got my name from this, Sarah Eastwood. So just ask for me. I'm also quite happy to share my email address. So if that's useful to you, it's sarah.eastwood@nhs.net. I'm very happy to hear from people and also be very happy to be involved as far as it's possible within my role or outside my role. In any of the innovative work going forward that I think, yeah, will move us forward out in this.
Okay, well, that's really useful to know and very encouraging. So, you know, thank you for that. And I mean, I think you've expressed, you know, a view which I think most people will share, that we really do have a lot of work to do to work together and to find solutions together. And you've expressed emergency planning as a much wider thing than just the incident response, which I think is really, really important. So, you know, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for the work you do. And thank you for, you know, the information you've given us. I mean, it's been great. So thank you for joining us. And we'll end this interview now.